debt. Their split had surprised me, if only because I'd heard that Carrie was as Christian as Teddy, although I obviously knew religious couples divorced too. I hadn't pressed Julie for further details, knowing how closely she guarded the confidentiality of her clients. At least that was the excuse I made to myself, so I didn't have to think about other reasons that the subject of Teddy made me uncomfortable. "How often does he get to see his boys?" I said, feeling grateful that Finch was the age he was. Then again, maybe things would have been different for him if I had made the decision to leave Kirk sooner. "Not often. It's a really long drive. It's just so sad." I murmured something noncommittal as my mother continued with further unsourced rumors about Teddy's ex-wife's current husband. She finished with a long sigh and said, "Anyway, there's nothing quite as sad as a single man's grocery cart." I exchanged another look with my dad, this one of the smirking variety, as Dad asked,
"Nothing, Judy? Really? Not war, cancer, death?"
"You know what I mean," Mom said. "All those sad TV dinners and that lonely six-pack of Corona. I just had to invite him." I cut her some slack as I really did appreciate my mom's compassion for the down and out, whether for a chained-up hound on an ASPCA commercial or a bachelor in a grocery store. She was proactive about her compassion, too, a giver, albeit a meddling giver. I knew this was just another example of those qualities, and that she wasn't trying to put me in an awkward situation. I told myself it really wasn't that awkward anyway. It wasn't as if we'd just broken up, or either of us held a candle for the other. At least I didn't. And I assumed Teddy didn't either. Otherwise, he probably would have declined her invitation. "I'm sure he'll be fine," I said. "It never takes a man long to remarry."
"Yeah, someone will scoop him up soon," Mom continued.
"He's so nice looking." "Maybe he's already been scooped up," I said, thinking dinner at our house didn't preclude a relationship. After all, I was married, and it hadn't stopped my mother.
"No," Mom said, adamant. "He's definitely single. Hey, I have an idea. Maybe you could set him up with one of your rich, divorced Nashville friends."
There were multiple things that disturbed me about this suggestion, though I was surprised it had taken her more than 10 minutes to use the word rich.
Dad, can you help me out here?"
"Judy," Dad said, shaking his head and chuckling, "that's a little bizarre, don't you think, to assign Nina as matchmaker for Teddy?"
"Why is it bizarre?" Mom said,
as I wondered if she was pretending to be obtuse, or actually was. It was often a close call.
"Well, because that's like me setting up Patty," Dad said, referring to his college sweetheart, who got way too much airtime.
Not from Dad, but from Mom, who clung to her jealous grudge after all these years. No matter that she had actually been the one to steal Dad from Patty. No matter that Dad had no contact with Patty whatsoever. Mom had friended her on Facebook. It made no sense, and was therefore a great source of amusement for Dad and me.
"It's not the same thing at all," Mom said.
"Oh? Why isn't it?" Dad said.
"Yeah, Mom," I chimed in. "Why isn't it?"
"Because," Mom said, trying to suppress a mischievous grin, "Patty is a hag." Dad shook his head as I burst into laughter.
"Oh, my God, Mom, a hag? You're terrible."
"I speak the truth," Mom said.
"She is a hag, and you both know it."
"Well, put out another play setting," I said in the voice of a game show host, complete with Bob Barker-like gestures, "because guess what? I invited that hag to dinner."
"Now, why would you go and do that?"
Mom said, helping me set up my joke further.
"Because I felt sorry for her haggardiness. Her cart was so sad, filled with Entenmann's coffee cake and prune juice."
Dad laughed as Mom pretended to be mad, all part of her anti-Patty shtick.
"So, what time might Teddy arrive?" I said, glancing at the clock on the microwave. 6 o'clock, she said proudly. So any minute.
Ugh, I'll be right back, I muttered, then retreated to the back hall to get my purse. I ducked into the powder room to brush my hair and touch up my makeup. It wasn't that I specifically wanted to look good for Teddy. It was something I'd do for any guest, particularly someone I hadn't seen in several years. A simple matter of pride. The doorbell rang as I was returning to the kitchen.
You should get it, Mom said.
Why should I get it? You're the one who invited him.
Nina, my mom said, her voice rising in a warning. Be nice.
I sighed, then went to the door, trying to remember the last time I'd seen Teddy, deciding it would be our first topic of conversation. An icebreaker, if you will.
Hi, Teddy, I said,
swinging open the screen door and smiling at a middle-aged stranger who, but for those ice-blue eyes, bore little resemblance to the boy I used to date. Don't get me wrong, it's not that he looked bad. He was still in decent shape, or at least hadn't gained much weight. Perhaps a function of being tall and having an active profession as a police officer. His hairline had receded more than I'd expected, but with a strong jaw and a nice-shaped head, he could pull it off. If anything, I thought he looked a little better now, having finally shed his aw shucks boyishness.
Hi, Nina, he said, looking and sounding uneasy. I'm sorry about this. Your mom wouldn't take no for an answer.
I laughed and rolled my eyes, saying, believe me, I know. Then, worrying that my statement might have come off as rude, I leaned in and gave him a quick hug. It's really good to see you again, I said.
You too, Teddy said, giving me a big smile, which instantly transformed him back to his old teenage self.
Too sweet for me, I thought, thinking of all the Boy Scout cliches that had defined his character, because they were things he actually did. How whenever he found a spider in the house, he'd catch it in a container, setting it free outside. How he'd shoveled snow for the old lady on his street without charging her or even taking credit for it. How he never cussed, using ridiculous substitute words like dagnabbit and jackwagon. How he prayed before every meal, including breakfast and lunch, but did it quickly and discreetly so as not to make anyone uncomfortable. He was sort of the opposite of Kathy, come to think of it. Pure of heart, without any showiness.
So it's been a while, I said, as I led him into the kitchen.
Sure has, he replied, then exchanged robust hellos with Dad, the two of them shaking hands with a simultaneous back clap.
Good to see you, buddy,
Dad said as my mother descended upon Teddy, giving him an embrace that looked more like the kind you'd give a relative who'd just returned from Afghanistan than like the way you'd greet your daughter's ancient history ex-boyfriend.
It's been since our 10-year, right? I said, milking the topic, remembering that I'd missed our 20th reunion for Melanie's 40th birthday trip to St. Bart's, a source of slight contention with Julie, who had wanted me to press Mel for a date change. It was one of the rare times I disagreed with Julie, insisting to her that benchmark birthdays of close friends trumped school reunions.
Teddy shook his head.
No, I've seen you since then. Remember, at Cootie Brown's a few years back?
That's right, I said, remembering the brief encounter we'd had at one of the most popular barbecue restaurants in town. I think I'd been back to see Julie's girls' ballet recital. Regardless, Teddy had been with his wife and sons, and they'd all seemed happy. I remembered feeling vaguely embarrassed for him. I think it must have had something to do with his still living in Bristol, still going to Cootie Brown's. For some reason, I made an exception for Julie, as I knew her worldview was constantly evolving and that no part of her mindset ever felt provincial.
When was that anyway? I asked, trying to distract Teddy from my mother's awkward, trance-like beaming.
4 or 5 years ago, right?
6, actually, he quickly replied, then hesitated and added, it was right after my brother had his first kid.
How are they doing? I asked.
Good, great. They had another baby, a girl.
That's great, I said, as Mom, slipping on her oven mitts to check her fries, chimed in with,
I saw photos of her on Facebook, quite the head of red hair. Which side does she get that from anyway?
Dad's side, Teddy said. His mother, my grandma, had red hair.
Mom closed the oven but kept her mitts on, pointing at Teddy with one. It looked like a foam hand from a sporting event.
You know what? I bet the two of you would have had redheads, she said, then glanced at me. It runs on my side, too, you know.
Wow, Mom, I said, under my breath as Teddy's ears and cheeks turned a bright pink. I'd forgotten how easily he blushed.
Well, he was almost my son-in-law, she announced, making it even worse.
Dad chuckled and said,
Sorry, Teddy. I'm sure you recall that my wife lacks a filter.
Yes, sir, I actually do remember that about my almost mother-in-law, Teddy replied with a wink.
None of us had expected this joke, at least I hadn't, and I laughed out loud, feeling myself relax. Teddy seemed to loosen up, too, going on to ask about my brother.
What's Max up to these days, he said.
He's still living in New York, Mom said. Still single.
Teddy nodded and smiled.
Can I get you a drink, Teddy? I said,
opening the fridge to find a six-pack of Corona, clearly purchased after my mom took note of his cart contents. Quite the thoughtful touch.
Sure, he said, if you're having one.
I hadn't planned on it, but took two bottles out, putting them on the counter, as I washed my hands and then took a lime from our always-stocked fruit bowl. Mom tried to make up for her lackluster cooking with a bounty of fresh produce. As I listened to her grill Teddy about all the latest crimes in town, I sliced the lime into wedges, picked the two best, and tucked them into the tops of the bottles.
Cheers, I said, holding up my beer as I handed him the other.
Teddy smiled back at me, tapping the neck of his bottle against mine, and said,
Two reunions.
And Sunday supper, I added, as we both plunged the limes into our beers and took long sips. Mom sighed a loud, wistful sigh and said to Dad, as if we couldn't hear,
Those two, they were always so cute together.
Supper turned out to be stress-free, even pleasant, the topics flowing easily from Bristol happenings to larger current events, including politics. One of Dad's favorite subjects. Everyone stayed calm and unusually neutral as I realized that I had no clue about Teddy's political leanings. On paper, I would have guessed he was a Republican, but I couldn't recall a single conversation I'd ever had with him about politics. Then, right at the end of the meal, we all simultaneously ran out of topics, creating an awkward silence and a frightening vacuum for my mother to fill.
So, she began, rising to the occasion, how is Kirk? You haven't mentioned him at all.
On the surface, it was a fine question, but I could tell by her expression that it was loaded and at least partially Merlot-induced.
He's fine, I said, then imprudently added,
I guess. She seized on my hesitation.
You guess? She said.
He's been in Dallas, I said.
Doing what?
Just business-type stuff, I said, sounding either cagey or dim-witted.
He sure does travel a lot lately, Mom said,
as I caught Dad shooting her a look. I think Teddy must have noticed it, too, because he conspicuously glanced away.
Right. Well, maybe you're onto something there, Mom, I said,
throwing her a curveball. She looked a little stunned. Maybe just confused.
What does that mean?
I hesitated, thinking of all the ways I could change the subject, then made a spur-of-the-moment decision that I was finished with small talk and surface conversation and diversions and lies of any kind, no matter how small. At least for right now, as I sat at my parents' dining room table, with a kind man who had once loved me and who still prayed to God before supper. It means, I finally said, gathering strength I didn't know I had. I'm filing for divorce.
Chapter 20. Lila. So it actually happened, I had sex with Finch. He would forever be the second person on my list. The act itself lasted only a couple of minutes, but that was okay. I think I actually preferred it on the quicker side, at least for our first time. For one, there was absolutely no mistaking how turned on he was. For another, it got us to my favorite part faster, which was just lying there together in the dark, feeling his chest rise and fall against mine. "Wow, that was good," he finally said, running his fingers through my hair. "Yeah," I murmured, more thrilled with every passing second. "I'm sorry it was so quick," he said, which I thought was really sweet of him. "No, it was great," I said. "It was perfect." "Your body is perfect," he said, kissing the top of my head. The compliment melted me, but before I could thank him, we heard the basement door open and a woman's voice. "Finch," she said, as light spilled down the steps, illuminating our bodies, reminding me of just how naked we were. We both jumped, then froze. Finch put one finger to his lips, instructing me not to make a sound. I responded with a telepathic blink, praying that the door would close. After an agonizing few seconds, it did, darkness hiding us once again. "Hurry, get dressed," Finch whispered, as we both bolted upright, frantically searching for our clothes. One of his elbows jabbed me in the side, and I could feel fluid running out of me, down my leg, but those were the least of my concerns. "I can't see," I said, when I realized I was about to put on his shirt instead of mine. "Hold on," Finch said, producing his phone from somewhere, then panning the lit screen around the sofa area as we gathered our things and dressed in about 20 seconds. "I thought you said she went to Bristol," I said, feeling grateful that Finch hadn't lasted any longer than he had.
Yeah, Lila, that wasn't my mom," Finch said.
"It wasn't?"
"No."
"Who was it?" I asked, although I suddenly knew, placing her voice.
"Polly,"
he confirmed, now scrolling through his text messages.
"Is she still here?" I asked. "How should I know?" he said, sounding a little harsh.
I couldn't tell if he was annoyed at me for asking a stupid question or simply pissed at Polly in the situation, but I said I was sorry just in case.
"It's not your fault. It's her fault. She's a psycho coming over here like this. And why are we hiding? This is my house."
Then he stood up and said, "Come on, let's go." "Okay," I said, only because it seemed to be the answer he wanted. Then I stood up and trailed behind him as he charged up the stairs. But as he turned the corner, I stopped just in time to hear her shriek.
"Oh my God, Finch," she said. "You scared the shit out of me. What are you doing?"
"What am I doing?" Finch yelled back at her. "You're the one who broke into my house."
"I didn't break in. The door was unlocked."
"That doesn't mean you can just barge in."
"I saw your car."
"So?"
"I thought maybe something was wrong. You wouldn't return my calls or texts," she said, her voice sounding whiny and desperate. "I thought maybe you'd gotten carbon monoxide poisoning or something."
I rolled my eyes, thinking, yeah, right.
"Don't be ridiculous," he said. "Why wouldn't you answer your phone or text me back?"
"Because," he said, "I'm busy."
"Doing what?" she demanded.
"Watching a movie."
"A movie?"
she said, as I could hear in her voice the accusation that was about to come.
"Are you alone? Is there someone downstairs with you? Is Lila here?"
It was horrifying to hear my name, yet also somehow validating, especially as I processed the jealousy in her voice. Polly was jealous of me. And then it got more surreal, because then Finch said, "Yep, she sure is. Hey, Lila," he belted out my name. "Come on up. Polly wants to say hello." It was my cue to frantically retreat, but Polly was too quick for me, whipping around the corner and staring right into my eyes. Later, I would process that my first and most immediate thought was that she'd done a shitty contouring job, her makeup way too dark for her complexion, likely in an attempt to cover up her freckles, which I'd heard she hated. But my second and more dominant thought was, oh shit, she's going to cry. Sure enough, she burst into hysterical tears, returning to the kitchen where she and Finch began to scream at each other.
First the concert and now this? She shouted. How could you do this to me?
We're broken up, Polly, he said, words that filled me with relief. Not that I doubted his story, but it was still good to hear confirmation. They were broken up. I hadn't just slept with another girl's boyfriend.
I want you back.
No.
Please, Finch, just talk to me.
No, you need to leave, Polly. Now.
But I love you, she sobbed. And I know you love me, too.
No, he said, his voice ice cold. I don't, Polly. Now get out.
At that point, I started to feel a little bit sorry for her, which sucked because I wanted to just hate her. I told myself not to be fooled, to remember what she had done to me. Then, as if refreshing my memory, I heard her voice turn from pitiful to cruel as she screamed, "You can't possibly actually like that pathetic slut!" And if that weren't bad enough, she added some really colorful stuff about how I'd probably give him an STD and try to get pregnant on purpose so I could get some of his money. I forced myself to stop listening at that point, focusing only on my breathing, fighting back tears, convincing myself how absolutely ludicrous her charges were. I'd never had an STD, and the last thing in the world I wanted was to get pregnant. I didn't like Finch for his money. I didn't want his money at all. She had me all wrong. She knew nothing about me. And I had no reason to feel bad about myself. So why then, I wondered, long after Finch had gotten rid of her and then driven me home, profusely apologizing all the way, did I feel so ashamed? Like maybe she was right, and I actually was a little bit of a slut.
Chapter 21. Nina. After a cursory kitchen cleanup, Mom always insists we leave the dishes for later. I excuse myself to check my phone. There is a text from Kirk that came in while we were eating, saying simply, "I'm home. Finch says you're in Bristol." I don't answer it. I then check my voicemail, finding a lone message from Melanie. Her tone is frantic and dramatic, as she gives me a convoluted report about hearing from Kathy, who heard from her daughter, who heard from someone else, that there had been some sort of Lila-Polly showdown at our house this afternoon. Lovely, I say aloud, contemplating what to do. Instead of calling Melanie back or trying to reach Finch to get to the bottom of things, I realize my only concern is for Lila. So at the risk of being a tattletale, I text Tom. I'm not sure if you're aware, but I have good reason to believe our kids have been spending time together. I believe they went to a concert last night. And I understand from Melanie and the usual rumor mill that Lila was at our house today. I'm in Bristol with my parents and don't believe Kirk was home either. Although we do not have a rule against girls being over when we're not home, we should. I did not give Finch permission to invite Lila over, and something tells me you did not grant yours either. I also heard that there was a situation with Finch's ex-girlfriend, Polly, coming over and confronting Lila. Details unclear and very possibly blown out of proportion, but given everything, I felt it was the right thing to share this information with you. I'll be home tomorrow, but feel free to call me tonight. I'm sorry. Again. I wait a moment, hoping for a response, relieved when I get it. She did not have my permission. Thank you for letting me know. I'll talk to her and be in touch. Feeling sick, but deciding there is nothing more I can do for now, and that there is certainly no point in trying to enlist Kirk's assistance, I put my phone back in my purse. Then I joined Teddy and my parents, who have retired to our back porch. Mom is serving her signature Pepperidge Farm mint Milano cookies with glasses of creme de menthe. I can see Teddy has declined the sweet nightcap and is sticking with his Corona. As I take the only free seat on the sofa next to Teddy, I have the distinct feeling they have been discussing me. "What did I miss?" I say. "Oh, nothing really," Dad says. "Is everything okay at home?" We all hear that it's a rather ridiculous question, so I smile and say, "No worse than usual." "Are you sure you don't want to talk about it?" Mom says. After dropping my bomb and accepting their condolences, I'd insisted that I would be fine and that it was all for the best. I'd even tossed in the glib but often true statement, "It is what it is." "Yes, I'm sure. Not tonight," I say, desperate for an emotional escape. "Why don't you just tell us some stories? You never have to ask my mother twice." She launches into a long, rambling story about my brother and me trying to get lost in the woods on a family vacation so we could be like Bobby and Cindy Brady. She then finishes by saying, "That was back when Nina was willing to go camping. These days, her idea of roughing it is a Comfort Inn or Hilton Garden." She laughs, then looks at me and adds, "Though come to think of it, I bet you wouldn't do those either." "Stop it," I say, feeling defensive. "I've stayed at my share of Comfort Inns and Hilton Gardens in the last few years," she says. "Absolutely," I say, pleased that it's actually the truth, although I don't offer that it only happens when Finch plays basketball in remote, rural locations, and I literally have no other choice. Nor do I confess that I've been known to pack my own pillow and linens. "Well, you definitely haven't gone camping in the last 20 years, Mom says, as it occurs to me that she may be nostalgic not only for the good old days, but also for the old me. "Other than glamping," she adds, shaking her head with something approaching glee. "Glamping? As in glamorous camping?" Teddy asks, clearly as amused as Mom. "Bingo," Mom says as the two laugh. Even Dad smiles. "That's a real thing?" Teddy asks me. Mom answers for me. "Yes, in Montana. Right, Nina?" "Right," I mumble, grateful that she doesn't also remember our glamping excursions in Big Sur in Tanzania. "And Teddy, you should see these tents," Mom says, making big air quotes. "Plumbing, heat, even heated floors, fanciest tents you've ever seen." I can't tell if she's calling me out or bragging, but she has the same look on her face she gets whenever she asks me how much I paid for something. "I know this is none of my business," she always starts, "but how much did this set you back?" "Subject change, please, Mom," I say, abrasiveness creeping into my voice. Mom's smile quickly fades as she gives me a sincere, under-the-breath apology, knowing she went a little too far. "No, I'm sorry," I say, regretting being so sensitive and dampening the jovial moment. "I really need to lighten up. After all, it's not a big secret that my life has changed, and that change has a lot to do with money. It's just a little embarrassing." "You shouldn't be embarrassed," Mom says. "I think it's wonderful that you've had so many neat experiences." "Me too," Teddy says, nodding.
"Me three," Dad chimes in.
"Yeah, I've been lucky. In some ways," I say. It's a reference to Kirk, and I can tell that at least Mom picks up on it. "Yes, nobody has the perfect life," she says.
"True," Teddy agrees.
"There are pros and cons to everything, every life."
I nod.
"I mean, I hate that my boys aren't with me full time since the divorce," Teddy says. "It stinks that they live in Charlotte, but..."
He pauses, as I wonder where he's going, what the pros to this situation could possibly be.
"They're in this fancy private school getting a really good education, an opportunity they wouldn't have had here, not to knock Vance in Tennessee," he says, referring to the local middle and high schools that we attended and where Julie's kids go now. "But Charlotte Country Day is way better. I could never have afforded a school like that, but their stepfather can, and he is happily paying for every dime. It's a silver lining for sure. You can always find one if you look hard enough.
I really hope so, I say.
Suddenly my mom announces that it's past their bedtime, but that you kids should keep catching up. Teddy looks as if he's going to announce his own departure, so I quickly intervene. One more beer? I'm not sure whether I actually want him to stay, or just want to avoid a divorce talk with Mom, but I'm happy when he says, sure, one more. As my parents and Teddy stand to hug goodbye, I go to the fridge and grab a Corona. While I'm putting in the lime, my parents walk into the kitchen behind me.
You okay, sweetie? Mom says as she initiates a hug.
Yes, I promise, I say, hugging her back. We can talk all about it in the morning.
Okay. Oh, come get me if you can't sleep, Mom says,
the way she did when I was little.
Are you staying here or with Julie?
Here, I say. I just have to get my bag out of the car.
I'll get it,
Dad says. Thank you, I say, feeling a wave of love for my father. For both of them.
Anything else you need? Mom asks.
I shake my head. No, thanks. I'm just really glad I'm here.
We are too, Dad says.
As I nod, collect Teddy's beer, and head back toward the porch, I can feel Mom watching me.
Have fun, she says, a little too eagerly. You never know what could...
Don't say it, Mom, I cut her off, glancing over my shoulder. But she says it anyway, a goofy grin on her face.
Well, it could happen.
You and Teddy, after all these years.
I forgot how awesome your parents are, Teddy says, when I get back to the porch, this time sitting across from him.
Yeah, my mom's a little nuts, though, I say.
No matter how much you don't like your son-in-law, and I suspect that it may be a great deal in her case. Normal people just don't say something like that on the same evening their daughter tells them she's getting a divorce. Then again, my mom clearly isn't normal, for better or worse.
She cracks me up, Teddy says, chuckling to himself. Always has. No filter. And I just love how she calls you out.
Oh, really? I say, smiling back at him. And why do you love that?
Because she puts you in your place.
Yeah, but there's a lot of hyperbole with her, too.
Really?
Teddy raises his eyebrows, then takes a sip of beer.
So you don't actually glamp?
I can tell he's suppressing a smile.
Oh, stop it, I say, as it occurs to me that he's probably a little more clever than I've given him credit for.
You know I'm teasing you, he says.
Yeah, but you think I'm a snob, I say.
Think? Teddy grins. Shoot, I know you are.
I say his name in a whiny voice, the sound of it putting me right back in high school.
Let's put it this way, Teddy says, as I hold my breath. You definitely like the finer things in life.
He speaks slowly, as if choosing his words diplomatically, but I still hear a euphemism for materialism. I must look embarrassed because he adds,
Hey, I get it. I'd drive an Aston Martin if I could.
I smile, comforted by this admission.
And anyway, I know you're a good person, Nina, he says.
I'm not sure whether this statement is true, but I believe in this moment that Teddy thinks it is, and hearing it heals my heart a little. More important, it gives me hope for the son I've raised. Thank you, Teddy, I say. He nods as we stare at each other for a few seconds. Then he says,
I'm really sorry about your marriage. Divorce is hard. It's a little bit like death or a house burning down to the ground.
I give him a sad smile, digesting the analogy.
Yeah, I haven't really processed it yet, but I know it will be difficult.
And just to warn you, it'll probably get a lot harder before it gets easier. At least that's the way it was for me. but it helps to know you're doing the right thing. That's just it, I say. I mean, it's complicated, yet also not.
I know. People always want to boil divorce down to one thing, a one-line explanation. He cheated, she's an alcoholic, he gambles, she spends too much. It's usually not that simple, but you still just know it's right.
I can't tell whether he's asking me what happened or just thinking aloud.
Yeah, I say. Our issues have been gradual and cumulative. It's probably not a tagline, but if I had to come up with one, I'd say we just don't share the same values anymore. Maybe we never did.
Teddy nods.
Yeah. Well, you'll figure it out. You're the smartest girl I've ever met.
Oh, come on. We both know Julie's way smarter, I say, still feeling flattered. I also realize how much I've been craving compliments about things other than my looks. All I ever get from Kirk.
Julie's up there, Teddy says. But she married a man who puts a uniform on every day and stayed in Bristol. She can't be that smart, right?
He smiles and sips his beer.
What's that supposed to mean? I say, wondering whether he's being self-deprecating or revealing his own insecurities.
I'm kidding, Teddy says, taking another sip.
Well, look, I say, just in case. You're right. Julie married a fireman and stayed in Bristol. I married a rich guy and live in Belmead. And who's happier?
Teddy shrugs, as if it's a close contest.
Not I, said the little red hen, I say, one of my mother's expressions.
Teddy frowns, looking deep in thought.
What are you thinking? I ask him.
Honestly?
Yeah, of course. Tell me.
He lowers his eyes. I was just thinking about you breaking up with me.
I didn't break up with you, I say, knowing that's exactly what I did. We just broke up.
Teddy meets my gaze, then, not bothering to dispute a basic fact, says,
on some level, you didn't think I was good enough for you.
You wanted more.
It's okay. You can admit it. That's not true. I answer quickly and emphatically.
Then what was it? He says.
Was it Kirk? Had you already met him?
No, I say. I promise that wasn't it.
Then why?
Not that it matters at this point.
My stomach in knots. I'm at a loss for what to tell him other than the truth. In a million years, I would never have imagined sitting on my parents' porch with Teddy, 20-some years later, telling him how I was raped. But that's exactly what I do. I report the facts, like a journalist, trying to get through the story without breaking down.
So you see, I didn't think you weren't good enough for me, I finish, feeling 18 again. Finch's age. A broken-hearted 18. I felt I wasn't good enough for you.
Oh, my God, Nina, Teddy whispers, his eyes filling with tears.
I had no idea.
Yeah, that was the point, I say. I didn't want you to know.
You should have told me. I would have been there for you.
I know, I say, wishing I could go back in time. Wishing I could do so many things differently.
Chapter 22. Lila. I forgot to close my blinds before bed last night, and the first thing I see when I wake up is Dad outside my window, crouched on our front porch with the garden hose, a big brush, and a bucket. The sleeves of his sweatshirt are pushed up, and his intense scrubbing motion reminds me of watching him saw or sand in his workshop. With a sickening hunch of what's happening, I get out of bed and go over to the window. That's when I see the neon orange letters sprayed onto the front porch. S-L-U is all that remains, but I know what letter is missing and what the word once was. I feel as if I'm going to throw up, literally, so I run to my bathroom, flip open the lid of the toilet, and wait. Nothing happens, fear and dread replacing my nausea. I walk back out to the hall, avoiding my reflection in the mirror, then open the front door, feeling the chill of the spring morning. Dad, who is still on his hands and knees, glances up at me and says, "Go back in the house." His voice is calm, but I know from experience not to be fooled. We are in the eye of a really bad storm. I tell myself that I need to follow his instructions, but I just stand there. I just stand there, staring. Most of the U is now gone, leaving only the SL. There are so many things I could be thinking right now. But I find myself feeling extreme gratitude that the paint is washable when it could have been permanent. Somehow I know that Dad isn't seeing the bright side. "I said go back in the house!" Dad raises his voice this time but does not look up at me. I back away a few steps, retreating inside, then run to my bedroom to get my phone. I have no new messages, nothing that came in since I last checked, sometime in the middle of the night. I quickly dial Finch. "Good morning," he says, sounding day after sex chipper. "No, it's not," I say, watching Dad from the window again. He is standing now, spraying the area with the hose, the nozzle on the most concentrated setting. Orange-tinted sudsy water runs down the steps and onto the edges of our lawn. "What's wrong?" Finch asks. "Somebody spray-painted our porch," I say. "Huh?" he says. "Like with graffiti? Someone vandalized our property. Our porch?" "Oh, shit," Finch says. "What'd they write?" It takes me a second to answer. "Slut," I make myself say, feeling a wave of shame. My dad's out there cleaning it off right now. He's so pissed. God, that sucks. I feel terrible. "It's not your fault," I mumble, my face burning. "I bet it was Polly." "I'm sure it was. Do y'all have cameras?" "No," I say, thinking of the Browning security alarm and all the nice things inside their house that need to be protected.
"Maybe your neighbors do."
"Pretty sure they don't," I say, feeling a twinge of annoyance. I get that he's just trying to be helpful, but he has to know that nobody has security cameras in my neighborhood. "I'll call Polly," he says. "I'll get the truth out of her." "No," I say, knowing it won't do any good. She'll just deny it, and it might even make things worse for me. "Please don't do that."
"Okay,"
he says, but he still sounds really pissed. "Finch," I say nervously, "can I ask you something?"
"Sure,"
he says. "Did you tell anyone?" I ask, my voice shaking a little. "What we did?"
"Hell no,"
Finch says. I believe him, but want more reassurance. "Not even Beau?"
"No. Nobody,"
he says. "I don't kiss and tell, Lila." "Okay," I say, wishing for one second that it were only a question of kissing. Polly would still think what she was going to think, but I'd sure feel better about looking my dad in the eye. I also can't help but think of how much easier it is to be a boy than to be a girl. Nobody is going to write the word slut on Finch's porch. That's for damn sure.
"Did you take a picture?" Finch asks. "Of your porch?"
No. Why would I do that?
"For evidence. You need to show Mr. Q."
"No, Finch, there's no way I'm telling Mr. Q. I don't want this spread all over school. It's bad enough that everyone's gonna know I went over to your house yesterday."
"So?"
Finch says. "You have every right to come over to my house and hang out. We're friends." My heart sinks as I blurt out, "Is that all we are?" I hate that I'm asking the question, but I can't help myself. "You know what I mean. I mean, it's more than that, obviously. I'm totally into you," Finch says, his voice turning soft. "And I love what we did yesterday." I smile, feeling warmth spread across my body, my regret immediately dissolving. "I want to do it again," he whispers. Dizzy, I whisper back. "Me too." Dad doesn't speak to me on the way to school, and I can't tell if he's more mad or upset. I decide that it's too risky to initiate conversation of any kind, so I keep my mouth shut for the entire torturous ride. When we arrive, he parks in a visitor spot rather than pulling into the circular driveway for drop-off, and I panic. "What are you doing?" I ask him, though it's perfectly clear.
"I'm going in to talk to Quarterman."
My mind races for a reasonable objection as I lamely point out that he has paint all over his clothes and hands.
"So?" Dad says.
I think of the movie Jackie, how Mrs. Kennedy kept her blood-splattered pink suit on because she wanted everyone to see what had been done to her husband. Not that I'm comparing the assassination of a president to our vandalized porch, but I can tell Dad, on some level, is glad that he's covered in paint. After all, he could have easily changed his clothes before we got in the car.
"Dad, please let me handle this," I begin to plead, but he shakes his head, as if to tell me there's nothing I can say that will change his mind. Then he adds,
"Is there anything you want to tell me before I go inside?"
I shake my head.
"So you don't know who did this?"
I shake my head again.
"I don't, Dad."
"Do you have a clue? An inkling?"
"Not really."
"Not really?" he says.
"I mean, it could be anyone. It could be totally random."
My last statement is ludicrous, but Dad nods, maybe wanting to believe that this could be true, that it was random vandalism, that nobody actually thinks his daughter is a slut.
"Okay, so hopefully this has nothing to do with the concert on Saturday night. Or you going over to Finch's yesterday?" Dad says sarcastically.
I look at him, shocked and ashamed, as he shakes his head sadly, then gets out of the car.
Chapter 23. Tom. I'm far from composed, but somehow I managed to keep my shit together for the first few minutes in Quarterman's office. Even as I show him the photo of the word slut sprayed across our porch, I keep my voice low, just as I did in the car with Lila. Somehow it helps that Quarterman is visibly outraged. "I'm so sorry, Tom. This is terrible, just terrible," he says, shaking his head. "Do you have any idea who did this?" "No," I say. "Does Lila know anything?" "She says she doesn't." "Do you believe her?" I let out a big sigh and shake my head. "No, actually I don't. But I can't figure out whether she's covering for someone or whether she's just scared." "Of repercussions?" Quarterman asks. "Yeah, this whole situation with Finch, it's gotten so out of hand." Quarterman furrows his brow, peering over at me. "How so? What's going on now?" I exhale, then say, "I don't even know where to begin." "Just share whatever you'd like to share," he says. "I promise you, Tom, I'm on your side here. I just want to help you and Lila." For some odd reason, and despite the knowledge that he has to also be concerned about his other students, as well as the reputation of his school, I do trust him. Or maybe it's just sheer desperation. But I start talking. I tell him about my meeting with Kirk, Nina and Finch's visit Saturday morning, and Finch's apology while I was out of the room. I tell him about the concert, and that Lila went over to the Brownings yesterday without permission or supervision. I read aloud Nina's text message about Polly. "Have you spoken with Nina?" he asks when I finish. "Since those texts?" "No," I say, shaking my head. "Not yet. But crazily enough, I feel like she's an ally here, to Lila." Yes, Quarterman says, nodding. I think she's really trying to do the right thing. Before I can respond, we hear a knock on the door. Yes, Quarterman calls out. We both stare at the door, waiting as it opens a crack. Yes, Quarterman says again, now sounding annoyed. May I help you? The door opens farther, and there stands Finch. Excuse me, son, Quarterman says in a stern voice. We're in a meeting here. I'm sorry, Finch says, but he doesn't budge, other than to open the door a little and throw out some bait. But I just had some information about what happened last night. Quarterman stands and waves Finch over to his desk. In that case, come in. Have a seat. I tell myself to remain calm as Finch sits in the chair beside me. Who did it? I say, my voice rising. Who spray-painted our porch? Finch takes a deep breath, finally showing his nerves, or at the very least some pretty solid acting skills. Polly did it, he says, speaking rapidly, or one of her friends. If she didn't do it herself, she knows who did. She was involved for sure. Son, this is a pretty big accusation to make, Quarterman says. Do you have any sort of proof? Not concrete proof, Finch says. But yesterday, Polly called Lila that word. You mean a slut? I force myself to say, my heart pounding in my ears. Finch holds my gaze, then slowly nods. Yes, sir. That's the word she used. Something inside me snaps, and I lean toward him, seething. Do you think you're at all responsible here? Finch shakes his head and says, No, sir. I didn't do anything to your porch. Well, don't you think your photo of my daughter contributed to this? Finch returns my angry glare with a blank stare. Any goodwill built up from his visit Saturday morning goes out the window, and I have to fight a strong urge to lunge at him. I don't understand what you mean, he begins. What Mr. Volpe is saying, Quarterman translates for me, is that your photo, the one you took of Lila, has perhaps put all of this in motion. Finch blinks, then boldly shakes his head and says, No, sir. With all due respect, I do not agree with that statement. This time I do leap out of my seat, taking some satisfaction at the look of fear on his face. Mr. Volpe, wait, please listen, he shouts, holding his palms up. I didn't take that photo of Lila, and I didn't write that caption, and I didn't send it to anyone. What? Quarterman and I shout in unison. I swear, Finch continues. Ask Lila. She knows the truth. Well, you either lied then or you're lying now. Which is it? Quarterman asks. I was lying then, sir, and I'm very sorry for that. But I'm telling you the truth now. I didn't take that photo of Lila. Well, I yell at him. Who took it then? Polly took it, he says, glancing at Quarterman, then back at me. I was covering for her. But after what she said to Lila, and what she wrote on your porch, she doesn't deserve my help. He shakes his head, then stares me down so boldly that I am positive only one of two scenarios can be true. Finch is either completely innocent or a total sociopath. He's either more like his mother or exactly like his father. I have no clue which one it is, but I will find out.
Chapter 24. Nina. I wake up a little after 4 a.m. in my childhood bedroom, knowing that I won't be able to fall back asleep. I'm just too anxious. My mind spinning with thoughts of the past, the future, and the miserable moment of limbo that I'm in. Part of me regrets my candor last night, first in telling everyone about my plans to file for divorce, because no matter what he's done, Kirk deserves the respect of hearing my decision before others.
but also in telling Teddy about what happened to me in college. I know what they say about the truth setting you free, but really, what was the point in worrying and upsetting everyone? Worse than regret about my past decisions, I dread what's to come. I dread seeing Kirk, and I dread confronting Finch about the concert and the incident at our home. But I know I must, and that there is no point in stalling any further. So I get up, quickly make the bed, brush my teeth, and get dressed. I throw my pajamas and toiletries back into my overnight bag and tiptoe downstairs, expecting to leave a goodbye note and slip out the door. But my mother is sitting in her bathrobe at the counter, playing solitaire on her laptop. "You're leaving?" she says, glancing up at me before clicking on her next move. "So early?" "Yeah, I have a lot of stuff I need to do today." She nods, then asks if she can make me a cup of coffee for the road. "That would be great, Mom," I say. "Thank you." She stands, walks over to the stove, and turns on the kettle. I smile to myself, realizing that she means instant coffee. Sure enough, she pulls out a jar of Folgers, along with powdered creamer and packets of Splenda and Equal. "Black's fine," I say, thinking I might dump it out once I'm on the road and wait until I pass a Starbucks, or at least a Chick-fil-A. Then again, maybe my mom's instant coffee is exactly what I need right now. We both lean against the counter, waiting for the water to boil, looking straight at each other. "I'm so sorry about you and Kirk," she finally says. "I know, Mom," I say. "I'm sorry, too. I know this is none of my business, and you don't have to tell me if you don't want to," she begins, which is sort of an unprecedented disclaimer for my mom. "But do you think there's someone else?" I shrug and say, "Honestly, Mom, I'm not really sure. Probably so, but that's not really why I'm leaving. I could get over an affair, I think, if that were the only issue."
"You could?" she says.
"Yeah, I think so. Good people make mistakes," I say, hoping the statement applies to Finch. "But I'm afraid that Kirk isn't a good person anymore." Mom nods, not even making a cursory attempt to come to the defense of her son-in-law. "Did you ever like him?" I ask, thinking of Julie's putt-putt memories.
"Of course I did," she says, a little too automatically.
"Really?" I say. "You can tell me the truth. Please?" Mom sighs, then says,
"Well, in the beginning, I was unsure. I liked him, but I thought he was a little snobby and that you two didn't really fit together. But I could tell you felt he was what you needed."
"I did," I say, nodding, amazed that my mother saw this so clearly, even before I did. Yet I also feel wistful for how things could have turned out, how we could have evolved together in a different direction.
"And I did love how he took care of you. He was a gentleman. But somewhere along the line that changed," she says.
"He changed.
He seems a bit selfish now."
"I know," I say, thinking that was an understatement. "When do you think that happened? When he sold his company?"
"I think so, yes," she says. "He just got a little big for his britches. And I also think he started to take you for granted. There's a certain lack of respect that disturbs your father and me."
I nod, knowing she's right, cringing at the example Kirk has been setting for Finch, and the fact that I've allowed it to go on for so long. I say as much to my mom and then add a hopeful, "Better late than never?"
"Definitely," Mom says,
scooping a generous tablespoon of coffee crystals into a University of Tennessee travel mug that I can trace back to the 80s.
"I think Teddy would agree with that statement, too."
She looks up at me hopefully. "Mom," I say, shaking my head.
"What?" she says with wide-eyed innocence. "I'm just saying."
About 10 miles outside of Nashville,
I get a call from Walter Quarterman.
There's been a development, he says. Can you please come in?
What sort of development?